just listened to Power and Praise here on WEFT Champaign 9.1 FM on the dial for a brand new day.
Dave Monk, Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign, 90.1 on the FM dial.
And Dave on the board. And today is 11-11. It is 11 o'clock. So this is actually, if this was Paris, I guess, armistice moment, right? This is November the 11th,
right,
Sunday.
On by happenstance.
And
the
this
11th
is...
The 11th hour is 11th day of the 11th month. In 1918.
And this is the Prairie Monk, WEFT's weekly look at rails, trails, greenways, all things natural and conservation-oriented, and whatever Dave is thinking about, which, yes, includes that this is Armistice Day.
And I grew up with this because this was the Commonwealth. The sun never set on the British Empire. And World War I, or the Great World War, was instituted with the Commonwealth involved, so many of the troops that fought in Europe and in Gallipoli were Commonwealth troops, many from India, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, Canada, fought that war. It was a rather cruel war, and I'll say a little more about it. I'm aware that there's a lot of understanding of it this week because it's got national time. It's the 100th anniversary of the Armistice Day. Armistice Day in Australia, at least, was very well recognized. It was a poppy day. Poppies were part. Real poppies in Europe where many of the troops were buried. Then they became cotton poppies and sold for a certain amount to support ex-service clubs and the like. The trenches were very muddy. The weather was cold and wet, and that was not what many of the people from warmer companies were used to, and clothing was not appropriate. There were mice and rats, and generally a bad thing. Rupert Brooke was famous as a poet, and he wrote a poem that many of us knew, and he died on the field in 1915, and I'll read his poem. If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam, a body of England's breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by the sons of home. And he was 29 when he passed. The war started in a strange way. It was rather Prussian. There'd been a Kaiser, and the Kaiser's father had been instituted for just 1 year when he died. And so Kaiser Wilhelm, at the age of 29, was the new Kaiser. He was fairly militaristic and had ambitions, and his army was serious and eventually controlled him some. In the early days of the war, there was a movement towards Austria and the East. The Archduke was assassinated, and that prompted a lot of activity worldwide. So that's when the Commonwealth got involved, that's when France got involved, Belgium, Holland. It was there in my day. If you didn't eat your cauliflower or your food, it was, you were told, think of the starving Belgians. So you knew the people that went. Often the farmers didn't go because they were to produce food, so they were detained to do farming. If the industries around it were needed, the women took over and did a lot of work that they traditionally weren't involved with. or allowed to be involved was a different era. But, so even though years after the Great World War, it was there, and it was, you had armistice days and ceremonies, and the returned servicemen were respected. Some of them didn't fare very well. They lost limbs, and some of them were gassed. Where we used to go to vacation, there was a Mr. Reynolds, and he lived in a building next door to where we were. And you always had to move carefully because he could hardly breathe from being gassed. So the I'm just reading my notes here. Germans eventually ran out of steam. Early on, they were producing naval vessels. My mother and her family came to Australia, had to avoid submarines that were German and very new. There were new planes, biplanes, and the like of Chinook Air Force Base was put together when early planes were starting to be militaristic in action. So the Great World War brought a lot of people together, and across countries as well as across nations. The Anzac troops went to Gallipoli and were mowed down by Kemal Ataturk, who was a fairly recent leader of Turkey, which was working with the German armies, so it was opposition. So many Australians, led by Churchill, were mowed down at Gallipoli. Some of the servicemen got plots of land, like in irrigation areas and things like that. But mostly the soldiers came back and fitted in where they were. Sometimes they didn't fit that well because they had what was then called shell shock. And but a lot of sympathy from the neighbors and relatives. Some of those people had gone back to as assisting with Boer War. That was a previous war. But you often moved into a house where there was a photograph of a military person in his clothing for the era. Then all that morphed into World War II. By 1939, the Australians were getting involved, not only in Europe, but in the Pacific. For some years, they had been, we were near a town called Kempsey, which also had fishing crews, and the Japanese fleets would come down and take the lobster pot that were set by the Australians. So the Australian shipping fleets were carrying guns even before World War II. And Japan is a country that has dependency on food and even now continues to harvest whales and other creatures that are endangered, mainly because they need that food. I'm kind of pleased to see that Japan is not producing more people so much. It's a problem because it means their aging population doesn't have the labor to support general function, so they almost have to immigrate people to do labor work. But it's not really a fun thing to keep looking for population growth so that you have a gross national product that increases every year. So I'm glad to see that some countries at least have a lower birth rate, and it does create problems. China has been into it with limiting families to one child. But there's a real resolution in some circles to make sure that the population does not outstrip the ecology of the world by overpopulated. If you do that, you end up doing something like the lemmings do when they occupy their take over their food and resources, and then it's a J curve where they die out, and a few remain, and then it picks up again. And the same thing happens, and that can happen to humans too. Well, then, when World War II came, some of the younger members of World War I infused into the army. There was rationing. There was a real attempt to not have lights shining at night, blackouts, blackout blinds, cars with little slits for lights, so you wouldn't create a place for Japanese troops, especially to be able to see what was going on in the world below. There were midget submarines in Sydney Harbor. There were shells across Bondi Beach and into the harbor area. So there was a gradual infusion of one war into another war. And a lot of ex-service clubs and the like, fairly male-oriented, when after World War II, when European displaced people were offered the opportunity to come to Australia, partially because Australia was looking for a white Australia policy. It didn't want the yellow horde from the north, and it was only in the 60s that was disbanded. But it was those people came and have been infused into the Australian population in much more broad base. They looked at the service clubs, which were fairly male, and put in their own clubs that were a mixture of males and females and families too. And so that changed a lot of the Australian way of life, which is sort of emanated from a convict era. And little things like food stores that never sold brains or offal foods began to realize that livers and other internal parts that were usually thrown to the dogs were valuable food. And so Australia has changed a little as a result of World War I and World War II. There were experiences that you won't forget, like recruiting events where cavalry was ridden across the country. It had its motorized vehicles too, but basically cavalry was going to be a part of the Middle Eastern war, and the horses along with the riders would go too. And my father would belong to the VDC, Voluntary Defense Company, and people were issued with 303 rifles, and they had to be able to shoot them. And so there were ranges where you could, as an organized group, could respond to military orders so that everyone knew what was going on. The little school where my father taught had a trenches behind it so that if you had war, that you had to deal with it. It was sort of little zigzag trenches about 4 feet deep, enough to cover a man in defense. The mountain beside was mined so that it could be blown up if Japanese troops came south. And people were involved in selling what we used to call lolly water, sweet water, just for a penny a time or something like that, just for funds for supporting the troops. People would be assigned to raffles. You would go around the neighbors on your bike, and they would have to guess the number of beans in a jar. And basically, it was a fundraising mechanism. The vehicles. There was gas rationing as well as food rationing, and the vehicles had gas producers where you could take charcoal and burn charcoal and get gas enough to run your vehicle. They were very heavy pieces of equipment, and vehicles often leant down on one side because the weight of the equipment to produce gas. They were called gas producers. And some of those people who came back from the like of the Burma Trail, where there was forced marching, more or less forced to make sure that prisoners of war for the Japanese side would not be participating again, and many of those people died on those forced marches, and the few that came back were respected in a very serious manner. And there's an Australian film which is fairly famous for dealing with that topic. Youngsters were sent from Sydney and Melbourne to the country so that they wouldn't be involved. The same sort of thing was happening in Europe. English young folk were taken out of London and sent to volunteers who took them on for many months and for the duration of the war. So we knew the returnees. We knew that there were the bus drivers and the like, and we respected them. So the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month is important to the world at large, and we hope that it doesn't continue, but there's still a serious concern about the involvement in the Middle East and different movements of population from country to country. Part of it has been the colonial system, which, whether you are British or German or Belgian or Spanish or Portuguese, you are moving out in the world and taking over resources and using them in a fairly blasé fashion. And that sort of disrupted the the native populations within themselves were controlled their populations and had their own organizations, and that disrupted things, and it continues. You continue to find that small communities are taken over by multinationals that feel that they can, with machinery that's available, can farm large areas, and that the small communities can benefit from that. They can get television and what have you, but it just completely destroys the rural sociology of those communities, and we're still doing that. Part of it has to do with making money and making sense and having a 1% that really has a lot of money, and sometimes very genuinely earned, sometimes not quite so genuinely earned, but it keeps power and has not always had a lot of respect for the laborers and the people that support that 1%. So that's still an ongoing battle. That's probably enough for saying something about Armistice Day, but we have to think about it because we're in the midst of these sort of international conflicts. I wanted to say that we've been thinking about the overall complex of prairie in our region. Prairie has been devastated by the fact that the glaciated soils are extremely valuable, and so settlers moving west took over land. They may have had to pay the federal government 7 cents an acre or 20 cents an acre or whatever it was, but they've the influx of immigrants from Europe especially was dramatic. Sometimes it was entrepreneurial. The people who came here knew what they were coming to, and it was a resourceful country. It was in the mid-latitudes. It had rain, and it had tremendous soils. So entrepreneurs were here, as they may have not have been in Australia, where there was a lot of dry land and not the rich glaciation that you have here from Laurentian Shield in Canada, which was also rich in rock and rubble that made the soils that were here. The prairie matured some of those soils and came back in after glaciated and retreated. So knowing that history, the prairie is down to 0.1% being saved by the state of Illinois, which was a prairie state. So that's very little. So we're talking to trusts and other people about the resources that Heartland Pathways has. It has 33-mile railroad bed out there, plus another 9 acres in the Rantoul area, which is related to a railroad corridor to Paxton. There's a complex, and I've been trying to think through what we might do to look at that complex. There are in there people who would like to take the in a helpful manner take charge of the more ice cream sites that are developable in people's lifetime, and they happen to be also the only remnants. The remnants tend to be on railroad beds. There's three little cemeteries which have up to 80 species out of 110, and they're to be cherished as some of the examples of what prairie was like in this region, and the region of East Central Illinois. So how could we go about improving that situation? how can we retain enough genetic gene pool that we can harvest bacteria or fungi or biochemicals in the future? Are we losing our ecosystems around the world at a tremendously rapid rate, to the point where humans have taken over, and even just the things we talk about from day to day, just the fact that we have a time change recently is where humans feel that they can change the nature of nature. And I'm not sure what the aim was, but I think the biological damage that does to your biorhythm across the country is being realized in Europe, especially, where they're wondering if this is a thing to do. And three states in the U.S. are not doing it, and I think there's a move to get rid of that. Well, this is just one of those things that humans do. It goes back to the days of very genuine Christian people who, like the Quakers, would be told to move in and harvest the tall trees for masts. And they did that in a very Christian manner, but it also invaded Indian territory and left an ecology that was deficient. It was often very wasteful. Even in Australia, where you have volcanic outputs that are valuable, the same sort of thing has happened. You go for the trees that you need for coach work and don't worry about the fact that you're also exterminating an ecology. So what can we do now that we have almost lost our prairie gene pool? And I'm thinking that things like reading the landscape at Parkland and following that, the master naturalist, the master gardener and master naturalist, I'm thinking too that we need for a prairie a backup, like the master gardener has a backup that includes floral arrangement or gardening. There's an applied aspect to things. We have a Natural History Survey, which has been renamed as an institute, was part of the university, which is research-oriented, but the gardeners have an applied as well as a fundamental research unit that's established and can help the master gardener. But I'm thinking that the master naturalist needs a prairie center. And I have a prototype for that. It's Northern Iowa University, which has a undergraduate and a graduate program. It has named people involved with prairie preservation, like Laura Jackson, a daughter of Wesley Jackson, who's a very prominent agronomist who understands the balance between ecosystems. She has just replaced Daryl Smith, who's been a NABOB of great importance in this. And these people have put together in the last 30 years North American Prairie Conference, which is held every 2 years. And Northern Iowa has become the archival place for proceedings from each of these conferences. But it's also a center. And I'm not sure that's what can happen in the university framework. It might be too applied. But if there's support, and I really enjoy going to Master Naturalist graduation meeting the other day, because these are the people who will be numerous enough to start to think about how they back up education for the general public. In Chicago area, we have seven counties, ring counties. You have a fair bit of funding and political clout. There are a lot of enclaves that deal with the preservation of prairie plots. Downstate, where land is cherished for its agriculture, corn and soybeans, then we don't have that. So could we have a modest prairie center here? It can happen in two ways. It could happen within the framework of the university as a backup to the master naturalist, or it could be outside the university. Sometimes institutions establish themselves outside the university and eventually are picked up by the university. So what would a center like that do? Well, I'm thinking of fairly simple things. The Master Naturalist program is wonderful. Could it have a seat on the WILL, parallel to the Master Naturalist call-in program? Maybe not. There may not be the population to support that. But so then, how do you relate to the region? If you have a region with three cemeteries and a few railroad beds, the railroad beds, especially the ones that are abandoned, become very important retreats for people who want to preserve and know how to preserve. So the teaching could expand to having a graduate student, or perhaps a PhD to look at this rather applied side of science. You have a genome people there nearby, and actually the genomes have to come from something that's an established plant or a bacterium or biochemical or what have you. So how do we enlist those supports? It's a very, very difficult and touchy problem, because preservation sometimes goes without the overall context. It goes to small plots, and small plots get together and make larger plots. But small plots have their limitations. They don't relate to each other. So if you have three small plots in a county, how do the birds from one fly to the other? How do the insects communicate? So ideally, you have counties that preserve a fairly large plot of land to allow that sort of interaction. And that hasn't happened here, unfortunately. There has not been the compromise where you say to developing settlement, we need to keep some of our nature together. Can we do that? Instead, there's been the move to utilize the water with irrigation, to dam the rivers, and we're having to deal with that. So when we look at Heartland Pathways with 33 miles of prairie soil that's reasonably undisturbed, you see that in some cases it's being invaded from the sides, in some cases being invaded across, even on warranty deeds that are very good deeds. So how do we, in a generation that's getting older, transfer that to a new generation? Tremendously difficult. You have to have lots of friends and relatives. WEFT has this problem of keeping radio program together, a radio station together. You really need people who have a commitment to bring together databases for contacts, work days for letting people have an experience with Prairie. I just went to a craft show, which is open again today in Nevada. And the number of people that I meet and exchange with aware of what we do. So there has to be some recognition of the people who have done this sort of work. And then to tie to those people, groups of people who might be able to take this into a new generation. And I think the younger generation is realizing that they will have none of the resources or very few of the resources that their great-grandfathers had and the great-grandmothers. How do we save the little pieces that we have? Well, one of the things that I have real conflict with is that rail trails are beginning to save railroad beds. And that's wonderful because railroads can transfer freight much more inexpensively and saving of energy than if you put the same material on the roads and that have to be repaired fairly frequently. How do we encourage those railroads? Well, if they're going to lose them and you're going to buy them back, buy connecting railroads back in 200 years, it was going to cost you a fortune and you weren't going to be able to do it. It's a little bit like they're putting ring railroads around Chicago so that trains don't have to go into Chicago and then back out. And just the attempt to get existing lines to be main lines is getting a whole bunch of challenge from the local communities that don't want the traffic. And the mountains of protests after protests rally has been through like huge mountains of signs and so you can see what might happen in the future. So having recreators look at a trail as a potential trail is very helpful. It saves a railroad bed. But if they're so wide that they take out the prairie, then you're in bad shape. So I've been meeting this week with foundations and tending to shout at each other a little. The thought is that from Monticello to Allerton Park, there could be a trail. The moment you put in a trail, you're going to have people who can use it for recreation. We put in 2 miles with the city of Monticello paying its own money, 2 miles from Monticello to County Farm Road to Applewood, where the new library is. Before the second part, the second part was an extension. It was rather wonderful. The first part was a mile over the Sangamon River on a truss bridge that we bought and saved. And it worked so well. It was safe, much safer than the parallel bridge road, which comes in off of Cloverleaf. And it's narrow enough that people walking or biking are going to be challenged. So this railroad bed avoids that. And it's quite possible to have a narrower trail than normal. And in this case, we have a federal and state regulations that suggest that a trail which should be wide enough and kept enough to avoid any creosote that might be underneath. And but in Monticello, the local city of Monticello has decided that it could be a narrower trail. The trees could keep the bottomland trees that it mainly goes through could be kept, and they could combine over the top of the trail, and it's a rather nice trail, and it's used by recreators, and it's used for safety. And it did have some challenges because kids that don't know better in Halloween or other times will set fire to the trestle and burn the trestle. And that costs $100,000 to replace, and a lot of inconvenience. But generally speaking, that trail has been rather popular. So then you go across County Farm Road, and there was a decision to extend for 2 miles, and Heartland Pathways owns that bed. It's not necessarily prairie, it's a bottomland edge phasing into prairie. But again, it's narrower, and so the vegetation on either side can remain. But it's really interesting that even before the trail was, it's set down limestone, chipped limestone, and before the trail was finished, the people who were exercising were enjoying the extended trail. So now there's a thought that that trail could extend to Armenia and then go around Allerton Park and come back into Monticello as a hiking trail rather than as a biking trail. The real problem is that once you put in a straight trail on top of a ballast, it is very inviting for bicycles. But you have a parallel road. Most railroad lines were paralleled by roads that came in later, and this happened to be the highway that joined Champaign and Decatur, and it's been replaced by Route 72. So it's now a county road, and it's wide enough to have a shared corridor. So we're suggesting that the bicycles go onto the shared corridor, and it could perhaps be a walking trail. So in order to do this, you have to have enough people that know what a prairie is and have a respect for it and want to save it. And in most communities in this region, there's very little known about prairie. They know the prairie soil for its fertility, but they don't know its bacteria. They don't know its dynamics because it doesn't stay stable. It changes. They don't know its past, and even if they do know its past, there's a temptation to look at this ratty prairie and plant a seed into it so it we don't get to know what was. We only get to know what has been changed. So how do we have perhaps hundreds of people who know a little bit more? And it's happening. People having prairies in their garden, in their front yard, in the little piece of land between the road and the walkway, which really is city territory, but cities are often letting that go because we need the biodiversity. It has to be a learning experience because prairie needs a lot of light, and towns often have trees that are easy to hug, and they're also give shade. So your perennial prairie becomes an annual prairie that you have to plant each year because it doesn't have enough light. So. So going back to the concept of a prairie center, and the perhaps that we might have a radio program that might be a video program, that might be a blog. A blog seems to be better than going on to YouTube. We go on to YouTube with this program. But it goes with various other conflicting happenings of the week. So you're talking today about armistice and people who are going to preserve prairie don't need to be bothered about the armistice deal. They need to be looking at prairie with fun and enchantment. And so you have Anita Purvis Centers, you have Abusey Woods, you have it's a whole lot of stuff is very positive that's going on. How do we continue that? How do we have a center? Do we create a center outside of the university, but use it to encourage the master naturalist that's been established within the framework of the university and within the framework of extension? Can we encourage that? It's obvious that the master naturalist is there because the master gardener didn't deal with master naturalists. And they might have a comment. I ramble on here, but David has been involved with this just recently. He might want to say something now.
And I should point out the reason I took the class is because I've worked with you, Dave, for the last decade. It's probably more than 10 years now. I finally got tired of being out there, and you knew all this stuff, and I knew nothing. I pointed at something. I think that's New Jersey tea. No, that's wild cabbage, Dave. Oh, rats. Okay. What's the difference between the two tall plants that both have yellow flowers? I could have sworn they were basically the same thing, Doc and
compass plant.
Thank you. See, I just took the class, and I need flashcards for all of this stuff. I don't know much about the history, but yes, you're right. The Master Gardener program has been going on for decades now, and the Master Naturalist program is less than 20 years old, I think.
Yes.
And I do know the person who coordinates the whole thing said that one of the fundamental differences between the two is volunteer work is built into the Master Naturalist program. It's kind of interesting. They make you pay to take the class, but then to maintain your status as a Master Naturalist, you need to put in 60 hours of work during the first year and a half that you're after, you know, from the class. But then every year after that, to maintain your status, you need to put in at least 30 hours of volunteer work. So they're designing into it the volunteers that the Urbana Park District, for example, and the Champaign Park District and the Forest Preserve and so on need to help clear out invasive species and you know, clear out various other sorts of stuff. So volunteerism, I'm sure that there are plenty of the gardeners in the area that do volunteer work. There are even some overlaps between the two. There are some area gardens, I don't know if they're rain gardens or what, that both the local master gardeners and the local master naturalists are interested in, and they will all volunteer to help maintain these areas in Champaign-Urbana.
Yes, well, the part of this is that you need organizers that bring these people together. They're interested, they're active, but they need someone almost with a full-time job and a commitment to the world at large to look at the overall complex that we have and then the little pieces that we could have and to look at the basic relationship between recreation and preservation. If you only undisturbed soil or relatively undisturbed soil is along a railroad line, you don't make the trail so wide that it will encourage wheelies off the road, beaten path. It needs education. It needs signage. So you need artists, and you need an impact that we don't have at the present time. But the Midwest deserves that sort of involvement, and we beg people to be involved. Do not do basic database very well. We are not blogged, so I have hundreds and hundreds of slides that pertain to this, but they need a certain amount of funding to make it possible. We need to live in buildings that are sometimes decrepit because we haven't had the money to work on them. We have railroad beds that have been challenged and dug up to some extent. How do we look at the five-mile connecting Clinton Lake with Welland Springs? How do we look at Shady Rest, where we would like the railroad line to go down and continue the interesting involvement of the Monticello Railroad Museum and the newly formed Champaign, Havana, and Western Railroad, which is re-railing into Champaign? How do we balance those things? It's a tremendous task, and we beg your involvement in the future. Let me see what we have in terms of 4 minutes. So part of my discussion this week has been the complex, the understanding of the complex of East Central Illinois, where we're losing a railroad bed in Arcola area, where we have Grand Prairie Friends that has done a good job with Prairie, but then it's gotten donations and activity in Coles County, which has taken them in a direction of forest land, which is much easier to preserve. One, because it's respected in a different way, and two, because there's no prairie left to acquire and work with. So we would be suggesting to the Grand Prairie Friends that they might be able to take over something like the 9 acres we have at Rantoul and work with the Department of Transportation, taking the corridor north on an old interurban railroad bed to Paxton, and perhaps even combining that thought with Kankakee and sand dunes and a different sort of prairie ecology. So how do we do that? I was so pleased to see so many people together at the graduation ceremony for the Master Naturalist, because I think that is where a lot of the energy is, a lot of the volunteerism is. Some of the people are older because they've retired and they see a need and an interest. But sometimes you have to look at retirees as people who are taking on their own interest after being very formally employed. They now want to do their own thing. So they're not always available for something like this unless you can convince them that is a thing to do. And that's part of the role of that we've had with Prairie Monk show, is to try and convince people that there's something worthwhile out there that is your gene pool, not only for yourselves, but for other people from the rest of the world. And we had a little pocket prairie across the road, and yesterday I was running into people who were commiserating us that lost it. We really appreciate the fact that there's been an empty building there for years, and this is going to be a beer garden associated with the poor family that is four poor brothers that are running a very modern style bar and spend a lot of money at it. So we can retreat, but we've retreated to the detention basin on 2nd Street, and that's a place where people are already starting to realize that we're doing things there that are interesting, and so they're noticing the pocket prairie in its new location. All these things add up to a future that we hope will continue. And in there, we hope to do some things for little plots that can be a reward in a lifetime, not in a perspective of 200 years.
30 seconds.
Okay. So I think we have to close now. This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign, 90.1 on the FM dial.
And Dave on the board. As always, the views and opinions expressed here are solely those of the speakers and no one else. It is now noon, and that means it is time for Shruti Music of India here on WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. We are community radio for East Central Illinois.